And this morning we'll continue the recital of the experiences which took place during the months of last and this year since we last met together. Matters which are to us the unfolding in a present day setting of the great controversy which took place up there in heaven, the better understanding of which is going to enable us to fight more manfully and decisively the great battle with the beast in his image there in the last days when the work shall be finished. Before I go on with this story, I'd like to just make this observation. I have found, I think that you folk can see this too, that whereas back in the old church things happened and we could never figure out what it was all about. Events were mysteries to us as to why this should happen and that should happen, but it's becoming very apparent that nothing ever happens today in this movement excepting that God makes very clear to us what the whole thing is all about. Not just the outward superficial workings of it, but the Lord opens up before us the very innermost nature of the thing, and we understand the hidden principles that govern the course of action which has been going on. I think you folk will appreciate too the wisdom of God in directing us during this week to study first of all the controversy up in heaven before we settle down to study the present day controversy, because we can most certainly understand the present day controversy far more distinctly and clearly after having first of all spent the time we did on a doctrinal, principled and prophetic investigation of the situation as we now see it. Now you recall that yesterday afternoon we got to the place in our story where in the last months of last year, Leighton was professing on the one hand a very real and decided friendship and confidence in the work and its leadership and the movement and so on, while at the same time artfully and determinedly pursuing a course of weakening and undermining the influence of those who are seeking to present the truth for this time. We noted, of course, that this was but a repetition of the work of Lucifer up in heaven, who, on the surface of it, presented a very nice front to heaven and to God, professed the greatest loyalty to the God of heaven, and yet behind the scenes was diffusing his spirit of discontent among the angels in the kingdom of heaven. Now, it's time now to link up the story of the Snows and Margaret Morrison with Leighton's story, because these two streams now begin to run together. Because, as you recall before, I had brought you to the place in the story where the Snows and Margaret Morrison had found a very, very common area of ground together. And the Snows said to themselves that Margaret Morrison was just the woman to, with the right kind of first-hand information, to write to Leighton and to inform him of the real character of the work down there in Australia. And so they proposed to Margaret that she strike up a correspondence with Leighton over here in America, which she rather eagerly did, and so that letter writing began. I think it was Leighton himself who told me this much in the orange orchard there at Palmwoods during the camp meeting. Leighton himself told me that the correspondence had begun, and very, very soon it had passed from being merely informative to being intimate, because he was a man who had a broken family life. His wife had not lived with him for a number of years, as all you folk are witnesses of. Down there in Australia was a woman, a married woman, whose husband would not live with her. And both of these folk, and that's no discredit to them, were folk who longed very much for a stable family situation and life. And as I say, there's nothing sinful about that. The only thing sinful about it is when they seek to satisfy a natural human desire in an improper and a sinful way, which of course they went on to do. So the correspondence began between Margaret and Leighton, which was introduced in this way, and during the last months of last year, it waxed more and more intimate to the point where Leighton at last decided he would come down to Australia and see for himself what was going on down there and also get acquainted with Margaret Morrison. Well, to the best information which I have got, and I think it's pretty reliable, In fact, I'm quite sure it is. Margaret Morrison, before Leighton even arrived, and by the way, she was the only person in the wide world, apart from Brother Rees, I understand so anyway, at least she was the only person in Australia who knew that Leighton was coming down. When I eventually got a telegram from Leighton saying he'd be at camp, I could hardly believe my ears, or believe my eyes rather. So anyway, he arrived down there, and before he arrived, Margaret had booked a motel down on the waterfront on the beach just out of Brisbane. There's some beautiful beaches there with lovely golden sand and very pleasant places for lonely hearts to get together. And so they lived together there for several days. And in those few short days, the damage was done. Well, Leighton then left Margaret for the time being and went down to Melbourne, and there he met Jack Sleeman and talked with Jack Sleeman. And Jack Sleeman is a man who went to college with the idea of being a minister, has never made the grade in that direction, and is a good man, and I think he understands the principles all right of how worker is called, better than he did back then. But Leighton proposed to him that he come to America and be the worker over here. And Jack went so far even as to get a passport and a visa and everything done, excepting, I think, for one or two final items. And for some reason, you know, that just did not mature. I don't know why. And then it was that Leighton came back again to Queensland together with Jack, and Margaret met them and drove the two of them up and onto the campground, and we gave Leighton a royal welcome. Took him in, and we fed him throughout the entire camp period. We gave him every hospitality, and we really rejoiced to see him there. It was a real treat to us to find this brother from America, Leighton of all people, a prince and a noble of Israel, had come to share the camp meeting with us. So, as I mentioned in the study yesterday afternoon, we met together at that camp meeting with the special burden of really seeking God's blessing, of putting away of sin, of reaching a depth of unity amongst the believers. And the very time when the camp of Israel was seeking to put away their sin and walk close to God, this prince of Israel brought this woman who had no intention of coming to the camp onto the campground, and there on the campground they continued their mischievous work under cover of darkness and so forth. I wasn't told this during the camp, but after the camp was over and the news was fairly out of the expectant baby, Then folk began to see the significance of things which they had looked at wonderingly before and couldn't figure out what it was all about. And then came and told me that at least on one night during the camp, both Margaret and Leighton spent the entire night off the campground somewhere together. And furthermore, every evening they went for long walks together in the beautiful Queensland bush, and in the very, very early morning, they had a meeting place also down in the woods just below the home of Brother and Sister Les Morgan. So there's no question or doubt about the fact that during the camp meeting they carried on the relationship between each other. And Leighton even went so far as to accept studies and gave three or four of them during the camp period. Although folk came and remarked to me, I thought they said to me, you said Leighton could give a good study. Well, I said, I must confess in America he's given some fine study, but I would agree with you that down here there's something lacking. They're terribly lifeless and dead and flat and meaningless and don't seem to get anywhere at all. Well, we understand why, because how can a man living in open sin possibly give a spirit-filled study? It's time now to stop the story of Leighton and go right back to pick up the other stream, and that's Bevan de Ruyter's stream. Bevan de Ruyter, whom some of you have met here in America, is a Dutchman, born in Holland, and came out to Australia after the Second World War as a European migrant on the Australasian government's migrant scheme. He was a German prisoner of war work camps during the war, and I don't doubt he suffered pretty severely there with malnutrition and improper clothing and protection during the bitter European winters, and had to work long and hard hours. That, of course, I mentioned to give him every fair excuse or consideration for his present behaviour and activities. When he came to Australia, he joined the Reformed Church, and for a time I believe he was a worker there, But if you talk to anyone in the Reformed Church today, they cannot find a good word to say for Bevan because of his high-handed, proud and self-centered behavior, which very quickly resulted in his being dismissed from his position as a worker in the Reform. They left the Reform and came out of that and was more or less... Well, there's a man in Australia whose name was Lance McNeil, and Lance McNeil was kind of preaching the 1888 message there before I came across to Australia, but he had it in theory only, and he went astray quite badly, left his wife too and picked up with another girl whom he still lives with and who has borne at least one child, but they're still not married after 4 or 5 years because he's still married to his first wife. Well, Bevan then in South Australia had left the Reformed Church. And so had the Bartsch family, but they had left it because of the efforts of Brother Charlie Morgan, who pointed out to them the fallacy of the Reformed position. And the Bartsch family are a very, very fine family, really one of our outstanding families in the group down there in Australia. Now, Bevan, I understand, has tried to spread the story around that he is the one who introduced the Bartsch family to this message. But I had very grave doubts about that, and so I... made it my business to ask Sister Bartsch if that was true. When she heard that story, she laughed and she said, "No," she said, "that's not true at all. As a matter of fact, we took up this message in spite of Bevan, not because of him. Because when you and Charlie Morgan first came to South Australia," she told me, "and stayed down there in Bevan's Arota's home, and we knew that Bevan was interested in this message, then they said, 'Well, if Fred and Charlie... are mixed up with Bevan in this thing, or we just don't want anything to do with it.' But somehow Charlie had given them a little taste of the message, and they said, 'Well, at the same time, I guess they don't know Bevan very well, so we'll go down and give them a hearing anyway and see what it's all about, and we'll just ignore the fact that he's down there in Bevan's home.' And so they came, not because of Bevan, but in spite of him. So that story which he tells you that he won the Bartsch family is just plain... imagination, so far as he's concerned, is probably wishful thinking, to say it in the kindest possible way. To say it in his worst form is just a plain lie. Well, just the same, we rather like Bevan. He was very gentlemanly and very pleasant and certainly showed great sincerity for the message. And as I said yesterday, in the early days of this movie, we were very naive, so far as people were concerned, and inclined to be too trusting altogether of folk. Now, that was back in 1963, and, I beg your pardon, it was very early in 64 when I first met Bevan. Just before I came to America for the first time, as you recall. Well, then, as the the months of 64 went by, we prepared for our first camp meeting in Australia, and Bevan came to that with his eldest daughter, Elizabeth. And at that camp meeting, he preached some really outstanding sermons. Very, very good. In fact, on the last Sabbath afternoon of camp, when a group of Reformed church people came in and kind of spoilt the fellowship to a certain extent, and I was very tired and worn out and a bit discouraged, we gave the sermon to Bevan, and he really lifted the camp out of the doldrums and put it on its feet again. And as a result of this rather brilliant performance, he could pray well, he could speak well, which of course is no indication of a worker whatsoever. As Sister White says there in early writings, and also in Volume 1 of the Testimonies, Charlie Morgan and Ernest Hunter and myself and one or two others there discussed the matter, and we felt that Bevan showed every promise of being a really good worker down there in Australia. And so we had the plan that in a year's time, or maybe 2 years' time, as things developed, that Bevan could be, we could go to the people in the movement and suggest to them that Bevan take charge of all the southern half of Australia, Victoria, the extreme south of New South Wales, and South Australia, while I took care of North New South Wales and Queensland. That was pretty well, and central New South Wales too, that was a fairly natural division because our people are concentrated in these two blocks, as you might say. Just as in America here you have the Western Bloc and the Eastern Bloc with very little in between. Now I want you to notice very carefully now that we actually purposed in our hearts to give to Bevan the opportunity of being a full-time worker. And we went to the camp meeting at the end of 1965 with that intention very, very clearly in mind. We were going to stand up and suggest to the people that now the work was growing a little larger, that it'd be good to have a second work in Australia, and that we felt that Bevan was a man who could handle that kind of work. And that was the thought we had in mind when we went to the camping at the end of 65. We had not yet learned that we couldn't appoint workers. That was a lesson God still had to teach us, and he taught us, as I said yesterday, an experience with Bert Morrison. Well, now, Bevan's behavior at that camp meeting was something which to us was an absolute surprise. We saw a different man altogether to what we'd seen the previous year. The man who brought with him to camp meeting a great big hound of some kind or the other, I don't know what you'd call it, a dog it was. I call it a hound because it's in the hound class. Not as big as a bloodhound or a... there was a big dog. And instead of going to prayer meeting every morning, he'd take the dog for a walk. And when he'd take a study, he'd talk for 10 minutes and he'd just fizzle out and walk out the back door of the room and leave the meeting hanging in the air. And his children's behavior was so really, really bad that they were using unclean language and all kinds of things. And when the young men were in the bathroom, they were messing around there and peeking and that sort of thing, that they became the talk of the whole campground. And we just knew that under those conditions we just couldn't go and ask the people to make him a worker. We just couldn't do it. Now it wasn't because of any change in our mind or any personal prejudice against Bevan that this change came, but his own behaviour made it impossible for us to set him up as a worker. Well, we didn't go to the people and talk to them about it, but we went direct to Bevan himself, and we sat down one evening in his tent, Charlie and Alice and myself, together with Bevan and his wife, Arlie, and we talked to them as Christian brothers, and he told us we came to him as Christians too, and he appreciated it, and we talked to him there for about an hour and a half or so, and expressed to him our concern over his behaviour, had told him that we had come to the camp with a certain idea in mind to help him be a worker, and appealed to him to check up on himself and to correct this difficulty. Well, he said to us that his one desire was to qualify to be a worker. His one desire. So he went back to South Australia without, of course, achieving his heart's desire there because of his own fault. And I followed down in about 2 months' time on my regular annual visit to South Australia and spent about a week or 10 days down there, and stayed, as usual, in Bevan's home. Now, I want to stress this fact. I stayed in Bevan's home to indicate that instead of having any personal bias against him, I always regarded him as being a brother and a friend. And he's been a man that I've always tried to help into a position that he made it very apparent he'd like to occupy. So he and I then, he came to me, we had a long heart-to-heart talk together, and he asked me to show him where he was falling short in his desire to qualify as a worker. Now, if I had known then what I know now, I would have said his biggest mistake was the idea he was anxious to be a worker. That was the biggest mistake of all. Because anybody who looks and sees themselves as only being able to serve in a higher position and not recognizing that right where they are is the place to serve has missed the whole point of the question completely, haven't they? They missed the whole point of it. Well, I couldn't see out back then in clear lines, and I had a long talk to him. And to encourage the man further, I cast my mind around, and up in New York, or Tanunda, I should more correctly say, was this group of very, very fine Lutheran folk, of whom you've seen in the films and heard a great deal about. And they needed to have a lot of good basic Seventh-day Adventist Bible studies on the nature of a man and death, and Daniel 2 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 11 and so forth, the Sabbath, and healthy, well, they're pretty good and healthy from already, and these things, you see. And I certainly had no time to give them to them because I was only able to come once a year, so I thought to myself, now here's a splendid opportunity for Bevan to come up here, study with these folk once a week, and help them to understand good, sound, basic Adventist doctrine. So I went to them, and I suggested it to them, and they welcomed the idea. So I then went to Bevan and put it to him, and he welcomed the idea, In addition, we arranged that we would pay Bevan so much a mile to drive his car the 50 miles up and the 50 miles back, and he'd begin to give these Bible studies. So it was all arranged. Now let me ask you, what more could I do for him? They were just putting things right in his lap, wasn't it? Right in his lap. Well, to my astonishment, I get home, and very soon, about 3 months go by, and the news finally reaches me that Bevan had gone up there once or maybe twice. And the Lutheran faith had said to him, "Well, Bevan," they said, "we appreciate your coming very, very much. We talked things over, and we think that we'd rather you not come anymore and give us Bible studies." And that ended that just like that. Now, I didn't stop it. Those Lutheran folk just felt he had nothing for them and asked him to come no more. So, I never asked them why, I just didn't pursue the matter any further. Because I know why, they just found Bevan empty and unable to give them what they wanted. Just so many words. And so that ended, just like that. Now, this doesn't mean the interest of the Lutheran folk had fallen away, not a bit of it. Their interest is just as keen as ever. When I go back down there, even to this very day, they keep me up till, well, the first night's usually 11, the second night's usually midnight, and the third night's invariably 2 a.m. before they let me go home. Was that a loss of interest? By no means. And when the real message is there, they just can't get enough of it. So I can't in my mind think of anything else but that Bevan just didn't have anything for them, and so they said, "Don't waste our time, don't come any more." Now at the same time, down in South Australia, we had in those days a beautiful group of people, every bit of the size of this group in this room, in fact larger I think. There were 4, 5, or 6 German families with young people and older folk too. There was an Austrian family, an Austrian brother married to a French girl, Weinhengst by name. And there were several other folk too, mostly of German extraction, and one Australian. And at that time, this was the fastest growing and the most vigorous and the best group we had in all of Australasia. And amongst them all, Bevan was the one who stood out with a knowledge of the statements in the Spirit of Prophecy. And don't miss the mark here. Bevan does have a very comprehensive knowledge of the Spirit of Prophecy and the Bible, along certain lines, mind you, of course. And what is more, he was the only one who had any ability as a preacher or a teacher. And so we left South Australia. I left South Australia. Charlie wasn't with me this time. On the way back to Queensland again to come over to America here for the 1966 visit. That's right, 66. And not only did Bevan have wide open to him the Lutheran group up in Tamunda, but he also had wide open to him the whole of the group down there in South Australia, and he had an absolutely ready-made opportunity to become a preacher and a full-time worker. It was just ready-made. All he had to do was to lead those folk into a higher experience, to bind them together, and to unify them, and all would be well. Now you know, you folk know what happened when you get together here in the Camden and you hear this message preached for a week. You all go away unified to a large extent, isn't that true? That's the effect of the message. Well, I was sure now that Bevan was going to make good and become a successful worker. You know that within 2 or 3 months, that group down there in South Australia was just torn to pieces. Just torn to pieces. I've never seen such a mess in my life. And every one of them, without a single exception, even dear old brother Teal, who stuck by Bevan as long as he could, had to admit in the end that Bevan was the one person in that group that was the fault. Well, we came to the... I couldn't get back there before camp time, but I appealed to Brother Schultz, who seemed to be the main one in objecting to Bevan, and I appealed to Bevan to come to the camp, and at the camp meeting we talked the matter out and see if we couldn't get down to the base of their problem and sort the matter out. So they came. And, well, we had some talks about it and got just about nowhere, but... the time came when one day I got Bevan and Brother Schultz together into a car, into my car, to talk the thing out, just the three of us. You know, I'd be the arbitrator in between. So we started off, and Brother Schultz never lost his temper at all. He was calm and quiet and quite reasonable, but quite firm about his stand. And we hadn't gone very far when Bevan lost his temper and just screamed at Brother Schultz. Just screamed at him. And I thought to myself, well, what's the use of trying anymore? In this man's case, but you know, we seem to take a long time to give up when we try and save these souls. And so Charlie Morgan and I went across to South Australia about 2 months after the camp meeting to, on the spot, get all these folk together and try and work out their problem. And they all said to us, just take Bevan away from us and everything will be okay. That's all we want. Just take him away from us. Well, I said, then you don't have to worry about that, because Bevan, I said, has told me he'll never come back amongst you anyway. And you know, but just as soon as Bevan left that group in South Australia, just as soon as he left it, all the trouble died down, and in the last 2 to 3 years, we've never had a scrap of trouble since. Been perfect peace since he left. Well, nothing would induce Bevan to go back and see those people and talk it over with them, just nothing. And so it was then that he wanted to come to Queensland. And Charlie and I said, well, let's give the man one more opportunity, and up there in Queensland we can keep our eye on him, because he always got along okay with Charlie and me when he was down there in South Australia. So Charlie said, I've got an empty house up there on the other farm, which you can have the use of for the time being until you get a place of your own. It's only an old house, needs a lot of repair and so forth, but you can come up there and stay there. So he came. We loaned him some money. And he still owes me the money I loaned him, and this is two or three years ago now. It was 1967, that's 2 years ago, yes, 2.5 years ago. And I don't think I'll ever see it unless I go and actually ask for it. Charlie Morgan went and demanded his money back, and he got it with a very bad grace from Bevan. And what Bevan said about us, that he'd...
He said he'd have to take the money back from you when you were
I guess it means a long time longer. It will probably be, he'll probably owe it to us all our lives, but he'll never do us out of it. So we don't care. It was only about $30 anyway, so maybe one day I'll see him and account for it, but possibly I'll never see it anyway. Anyhow, now that Bevan was up there, the first thing I did was to, because he was new in the area and hadn't found his speech yet, to help him out, we gave him the job of helping me to build the bathrooms and the toilets on the back of the old house in preparation for the coming camp meeting. There was just no worthwhile laundry, and the toilet was a... it's hard to describe, but it just wasn't anything you'd even think about. It reminds me of that toilet way up there in Manitoba where the winter winds howl through and so forth. But this one was propped up by two or three sticks, and when the wind blew, it changed its angle. When the wind blew the other way, it changed its angle back this way, and so it was hardly fit for camp time. So we rebuilt that, and I said to him, now I said, you are very keen in medical missionary work. I said, that's good. We want to see the medical missionary work developed in this movement. I said, so is Charlie Morgan, I said. So now the two of you could work together. I said, Charlie's one of your best friends, and here you have a wonderful opportunity. Go to work. And I said, there's plenty of sick people around Parliament and Nambour. Go to work, win some souls, and really find yourself a place in the work where you want to be most of all. And later on in a couple of years' time, when the South Australian folks see that you are a changed man, then you'll probably work yourself into the position of your heart's desire. So I came to America in 1967 quite confident that Charlie and Bevan would make a wonderful team together, and that they would be real missionaries and build a medical missionary program down there in Queensland. Imagine my consternation, dismay and shock when in just a short while I begin to get information from down home that Bevan was once again the catalyst of trouble in Palm Woods. And very soon he and Charlie were not working together anymore. And I'm perfectly satisfied in my mind that the fault doesn't lie with Charlie, because Charlie is one of the nicest, amiable chaps you'd ever want to find anywhere in the world, and a real success as a medical missionary, believe me. He does have souls to his credit. There's the Dudaco family up in Billowera, just out from Rockhampton, a really fine family. They're as solid as a rock for this message, purely and simply because Charlie went to them with a medical missionary program. Sister Judaico was down on a bed of sickness with asthma, and she hadn't got out of that bed excepting for just brief seconds of time for months and months and months and months on end. The doctors couldn't help her. No one could touch her. Then Charlie went along there with a few brief treatments, and after the first weekend of treatment, she got out of that bed, and she'd never been back since except to sleep at night. And I won't take time now, but we could tell you story after story after story of how he's helped folk around Palmerston. He's a real success as a medical missionary. I hope someday that when he can become a little less involved with the farming program, he can come across with me and have you folk meet him and give you some talks of his experiences in the medical missionary line, which he's taken up just as an individual and is carrying on down there with great success around Palmwoods. I should mention too that Lynn Cole, one of the Lutheran folk down in South Australia, is also a great success in the medical missionary work, and both of these folk do this in the lay capacity in their spare time, and they just cannot keep up with all the patients who come to them, and they have success after success. But Bevan has had no successes I can think of or can see down there. It seemed that he antagonises these patients and they go to him for a while, and Charlie Morgan has found person after person come to him who first went to Bevan, got no relief, have come to Charlie and have got relief and gone away, different people altogether. So I went back to Australia at the end of the year, and I had a pretty straight heart-to-heart talk with Bevan and expressed to him my concern over his behaviour, but of course he wasn't to blame. Everybody else was to blame but him. And in particular, of course, he had a big bone of contention about the way in which Australians, as he claimed, just didn't take the foreigners. Now, if ever I heard nonsense, that's just about it, because the Australians are accustomed to foreign folk coming to live amongst them, and generally speaking, the Australians make foreigners very welcome. We had Czechoslovakians, Germans, Italians, Dutch, Danes, Norwegians, Scandinavians, Italians, Maltese. All those European races are finding a home down in Australia at the present time, and the Australian, generally speaking, makes them very, very welcome. And certainly, the people that Bevan goes to war with don't go to war with him because he's a Dutchman, but because he's Bevan de Ruyter. And that's the point. Well, when he was in South Australia amongst our folk, he caused war and strife. When he left them, peace returned. Before he came to Queensland, there was perfect peace and unity amongst the believers. When he came in, there hasn't been peace since. And we're looking for the happy day when he leaves us, so peace will return. It will. Although at the present time, of course, he's just about no longer giving us any trouble because of he's now really ruined himself because of his past activities and program. All right. Well, now, Bevan came to the place in the last months of last year where he recognised the fact that he hadn't behaved himself the best, after all. And then, but in the meantime, as I mentioned yesterday, he began to go out ostensibly to win this other Dutch family who were atheists to the message, and they spent all their Saturday nights watching television programs. Instead of they being one to the message, then the influence of these other neighbours dragged away their experience. And when their experience was dragged away and they no longer had that living faith, then they went and tried to win some Brinsmead folk to the message, and instead of that they came away with their own minds changed, and Bevan now believing that sin doesn't reign but it does remain, that are you in Christ, not unless you acknowledge yourself to be an erring, helpless, condemned sinner. And these things were developing in him as he came up toward last camp meeting down there in Australia. And so it was, I mentioned yesterday, right there in the middle of that camp meeting, he stood up and preached that sermon, of which you folk have seen the typewritten transcript that I have here in my hand, and that was just what Leighton needed at that point of time to confirm him in his program of putting himself in the place of God and setting up a worker in this country, as I related to you yesterday. And so it was that all these streams of discontented people came together at a certain point of time. By chance? Not by chance. By whose cunning and careful planning? God's? Certainly not. By Satan's cunning and careful planning, because Satan knows how close this people is to the Jordan River. Satan knows he has now but a desperately short space of time, and he knows that at all costs he has to break up this moon before it is forever too late for him. And that is why in the last 12 months he has put together a campaign of attack against this movement, the like of which we have never before seen in our history. But I praise the Lord that God was too much for the devil. He overreached himself, and just as Balaam found he could not curse Israel, so these modern Balaams and Zimris have found they couldn't curse Israel either. Now we brought all these streams into one. Let me just finish now the last part of the story, which is relatively brief, as we come down to the situation which exists at the present time. Well, as I said yesterday or the day before, Bevan went at once to Sister Bach and told her the whole story of this great scheme to take him to America, where he's going to be a big-time preacher at long last. And she, of course, in great concern, came and told us. And I went to Layton, or I went first of all to Charlie Morgan and Alice Hunter, and talked the matter over with them, because these are two men that I counseled with first of all before he told me further. And it was agreed that I should talk to Layton on my own first of all, if he didn't respond to that, that we'd all talk to him together. So I talked to Layton, and I just laid out him before these principles of gospel order as found in the little book, Early Writings, and told him he didn't know Bevan. I said, because a man can preach well and pray well, that doesn't prove a thing. All false workers can preach and pray well. They can sound good, but we have to look a lot deeper than that. Well, he apologized for having even made the proposition and promised me there and then that the whole matter was dropped. He wouldn't go an inch further with the thing. And voluntarily, he went out and told the same thing to Charlie Morgan and to Alice Hunter. I hadn't asked him to. He went and did it voluntarily. And when he did it voluntarily, well, I felt quite convinced that he meant what he said. But since that time, we have discovered that while he said that and gave to us the appearance of loyalty and truth and honesty, that he went along just as busy as could be behind the cover of that falsehood, paying the whole thing as if he'd said to us, I'll do it whether you like it or not. Well, I went to New Zealand, and Margaret and the children were with me. We came back to discover that Bevan had been very busy during our absence and gone around diffusing his discontent amongst the group in Palmwoods, and really split them now into two parties. On one side, he had Helen Murchison together with Brother and Sister Bernard, and Margaret Morrison, of course, stood with them because she was involved with Leighton anyway. And on the other side, of course, stood Charlie Morgan and his wife, Les Morgan and his wife, and Brother and Sister Rendell. And naturally, of course, we stood with them because we could see the wrong principles that Bevan was exerting. Well, he began to make the same charges exactly as Cordathan and Byron did back there against Moses, and he called for a reorganization of the whole movement, just as Lucifer did up in the Kingdom of Heaven. Because Bevan could see that while the movement was organized as it was, which system is patterned after God's own plan, the voting system and so forth, he had no hope in the wide world of getting the position which he so anxiously longed to have. Well, I was about to go to Africa, and I was in a desperate circle of work and rush at the time with messengers to get out and whatnot, so I didn't have time to go and settle the issue with these folk. And anyway, I thought to myself, there's nothing too much to worry about, because Leighton has told us that Bevan's not going to America anyway. And then out of the blue, Leighton writes to me and says that over here in America, he has got together with the believers here, and he said, we have decided to call Bevan to America. We hope that you agree. Tell us, please write and tell us that you do. Had a medical mystery, yeah. Oh, I wasn't surprised about that. I figured he'd seen maybe two or three people.
When he came back, he talked to me that day. When he came back that time, he also made the statement he would fell down because of his being a German.
We never intimated anything like that when they wrote up.
Well, as my account here shows, far from holding Bevan down, we had tried hard to open up the doors of opportunity for him.
That's as far as I've ever went. So I see that paper and I looked it over and just set it aside. I've been so busy.
Sometimes being very busy can be a salvation, can't it? But that's Bevan's whole attitude in life. He always pictures a poor Bevan story, a persecuted Bevan story. And he tries to enlist the sympathy of people because he's always trying to make it. He's never had an opportunity in life, and if only somebody would give him a chance, well, he'd really display his talents and abilities. That's always been Bevan's attitude. And we've been very distressed too by the fact that, we were quite shocked and horrified. And this is a factual story. Everything I've told you here, if you want to question any of it, I can fetch up three or four witnesses to every single point and prove these things to be so. Now, Brother Anderson is a relatively new believer in this movement, and Brother Anderson down in Australia is a hard-working man, and I wouldn't like to say that he is rich by any means, but he's a man who works for his living, who works hard and is able to buy what he wants. He doesn't have a flash home, he doesn't have a very, very flash car either. He only has a Holden, doesn't he? What does he have? No, it's a little Morris. That's right, it's a Morris. Not a very big car, but it's no bigger than the Mustang, as a matter of fact, out there. And, but he just has that look about him, the man that, there's where he's going, and Bevan got the impression he's a man of money. Now, whether he is or not, I don't know. I honestly don't know. Pardon? He's a kind-hearted, generous man. So Bevan goes along to Brother Anderson with the testimonies under his arm and reads to him all these statements about the rich brethren should help the poor brethren in the movement and give them handouts, you see. And, of course, Brother Anderson thought that Bevan was going to present to him the case of some destitute widow in the movement somewhere, who had no money, whose husband had died and had 10 children or something like that. And then the next thing, Bevan turns around and tells him how his poor old car is about falling to pieces and that if he doesn't get a new one soon, he'll be in a desperate plight. And Brother Anderson said to himself, well, how is this? This man's able-bodied, he's a skilled tradesman, he's a carpenter, he does naturopathy on the side, so what does he need to go begging for himself for? That's right, he's a carpenter too. So he just didn't sort of respond. And then in the South Australian camp at Easter last year, Bevan came back to him with the same plea, and this time made it much more pointed. So then Brother Anderson came to us and asked us what Bevan's situation was, and we were shocked and horrified to think that an able-bodied man would go around and literally beg for money like that. That was something I just couldn't understand that he could do. Anyway, that's Bevan all over. Wherever he goes, he'll pitch the poor Bevan story, persecuted, kept under, henpecked, and all that sort of thing, when it's the opposite is absolutely true. A man who had opportunity after opportunity, and who himself has ruined those opportunities. Anyway, as I was saying, so I determined then to have a talk to Bevan, seeing that this thing was in the air, and see what he had to say, and he decided to have a talk to me the same night. So we met together the same night, and honestly, I have seldom been subjected to the ordeal I went through that Tuesday evening from about 9 o'clock till midnight. My wife doesn't look like a drawn, grey, haggard man for several days afterwards. It wasn't very pleasant, believe me. Bevan stood there at my... I was sitting up on a bench on the folding machine. He stood in front of me, and he brought his face to them about a foot of mine, and his eyes were blazing. And there was a wild intensity in his voice, and he charged me with being a one-man movement and being a dictator and holding everything to myself and keeping him out and not giving me any opportunities, whereas the whole opposite was true. So I got nowhere with him, and then it was I came to... I said, well, I'll have to answer later before I go to Africa. So I went into the tape recording room, and I made a tape which some of you folk may have heard and for which I make no apologies whatsoever. Maybe not. Did any of you folk hear the tape I sent to Leighton? Did you hear it, Mr. Belshi? About Bevan? About Bevan, yeah. Now, that tape was an honest attempt to fulfill the instructions given in Early Writings, page 100, where Sister Y says that we are to act and let it be known that we don't support these folk and why. And you didn't hear that one? No, that's a different one. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, it was sent to Brother Reese, but the Reese heard it. Margaret? Brother Reese heard it. A copy went out to Silas and to Brother Reese out there in Canada. Well, now I admit the tape was made in haste, and if I had more time I might have said a few things. I said the same thing, but perhaps phrased it a little bit differently, so as not to give them the opportunity of misconstruing my words and so forth. Anyway, I said to Leighton, now look, I said, you ought to play this tape to those people with whom you have already planned and conferred to bring Bevan to America, so that if they bring Bevan to America now, they will do it far more intelligently than previously, and they cannot turn around later and blame you for imposing upon them a man who cannot live up to the expectations which you have suggested he has. Well, what did Leighton do? He turned straight around and sent the tape back to Australia, and to Margaret Morrison, who in turn just as promptly played it to Bevan and Helen Murchison and to the Bernards. And that, of course, really put the fat in the fire. Oh, my, the fun and games were really on now, as you can imagine. But I'm glad it happened. I'm not a bit sorry.
You were in Africa.
I was in Africa, because I didn't have to suffer the immediate backlash of it. But when I got home, I made it my first business to call Bevan and ask him to come and sit down with me and have a talk. So we barely got started in this talk, and I said to him, now look, I said, I have not communicated with America in regard to you, excepting, I said, with Leighton. Because I said he was out here, and the question was already raised while he was out here. And I was going to go on and tell Bevan that this little bit of paper has been around, and I had got a number of letters from several different folk over here in which they had said, who is this Bevan de Ruyter? And they had stated in that letter that this was just not the truth of the message, but was an apostasy from it. And I was going to tell him these things to shake him up and wake him up a little bit. When he turned around and said to me, you've communicated with nobody over there? I said, no one but Leighton, which was the truth at that time. I've since communicated, of course, with a lot of people. He said, Freddie, said, I've heard the tape you sent to Leighton. I said, have you? He looked at me and he thought I'd just go red and pink and white and a few other colours. And I just leaned back in my chair and smiled and said, well, Bevan, I said, I'm very glad you have. Because I said, that saves me the task of repeating it all over again to you, as I said in the tape I intended to do. Well, now it was his turn. It was his turn to look silly, because he just didn't expect that kind of answer. He thought I would be flabbergasted, but I made that tape with no more malice than I'm speaking now. And I don't think you can detect any malice in me at the moment, because there isn't any anyhow. I'm treating this thing coldly, factually, and objectively. So we talked there for a while, and he really bent over backwards to give to me the impression that he took no resentment from that thing at all, that he understood why I'd done it, and that I had needed to do it, but just give him a chance, and he proved to us that he was a changed man. And now for the next few weeks, every sermon he took, somewhere or the other, he would tell us that he was a changed man, but how hard it was, the great sorrow of his life, was he couldn't prove to us that he was a changed man. And the idea was, of course, in his mind, that inasmuch as he was a changed man, that now we ought to recognize the fact and gladly promote him to the position which in his own mind he thought of himself as occupying. I tell you, if I have ever seen the mind of Satan, I certainly saw it in that man, because just as Lucifer up in heaven saw himself as being far better than he was, and saw himself in a position far above where he stood, so Bevan saw himself in that position and expected us to put him there, just as Lucifer expected God to put him in the higher position. But there was too much about Bevan that we just didn't, that made us very suspicious and very careful.
You mean after going on?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very great.
Oh, sure. Definitely. Well, but when you lose the message and take this sort of thing up, then pride can't help but take hold of your heart. And when pride takes hold of your heart, you never see yourself as you are, but you see yourself only as being better than all the rest of the world, you see. Well, then it was about this time the news came out that Leighton had come down to Australia and Margaret Morris was expecting his baby. So now I was very confident that Bevan would at least have enough good sense in his head to say, well, if that's the, what shall I say, the connotation or the surroundings or the source through which my call into God's word came, then I'll drop the call just like that. Because I said the other day, what person in this room today, what one of us would dare to take up the work of God if the call came from a man living in adultery and stubbornly living in adultery? I tell you, I wouldn't. If a call comes to me, the first thing I want to know is this call from God, or am I following out the dictates of my own desires or the wishes of somebody else? When I first came to America, I put that thing to a solid test for a whole month, and I wouldn't move from Australia until I knew that every believer in the church in Australia saw with me that God was in this thing. And only then did I come. And I'm certainly glad, in view of my first experiences here, that I did test that call, else my faith could never have endured the test I went through when I got over here. Could never have endured it. Well, remember that the messengers who came to Balaam and called him to a far country withdrew the call and went off and left him. And you know, at Leighton, when the news of his adultery came out, he wrote down to me, told me how sad he was about it all, and told me that so far as he was concerned, he had dropped the whole thought of bringing Bevan to America. And if Bevan came there, he'd have to come on his own money, and he'd have to come on his own volition, And if he did come, he'd make him welcome, and they'd make a few tapes for the radio, and that's about as far as it would go. And Bevan knew this. He knew the call had been withdrawn from him. And one thing which held him up was getting his visa and passport, because he was a Dutchman living in Australia, and took a little time, more so than Australian would take in his own country. But remember this, that when Balaam saw that the call was being withdrawn from him, that with frenzied haste, Balaam grabbed his ass and rode after those men for fear that somehow something would stop that call from coming to fruition. And like manner, Bevan de Rooy was in the middle of a job, working for Helen Murchison, and another 2 or 3 days would complete it. He knew Leighton was out in Tennessee. He also knew there was a possibility of Leighton coming back to Australia. And Bevan was desperately afraid that something would stop his getting to America. And so he dropped that job right in the middle of it. The very day he got his passport and visa, he grabbed an airline ticket and he came across to America. Just like Balaam, he just couldn't wait for fear that something would stop his getting here. Now the night before he left to come to America, he sat there in our little tape recording room, the one you saw in the films the other night, and told me he was going, made a great profession of loyalty and love to us and so forth. And I talked back to him and I told him that he went, and I wanted him to know that in his going, that I could see it was not from God and God wouldn't bless it. He wouldn't get what he went for, and he was being a very foolish man. And I asked him, I said, Bevan, I said, do you have a call from God to go to America? He said, no, I haven't. He said, I have no call from God to go to America. Well, I blinked. I mean, I just couldn't believe my ears. And so much so, well, I just couldn't accept it. It was so, such an answer was so incomprehensible to me that I couldn't even believe it. I expected him to say, why, sure, I've got a call from God to go to America, which, of course, I wouldn't believe to be the truth, but you find that all these self-centered workers will always claim to be called of God, every one of them. So a few minutes later, I repeated the question, which was in the back of my mind. I just wanted to be sure I'd heard straight. He said, no, he said, I have no call from God to go to America. None whatsoever. I said, Bevan, I said to him this time, it now sunk in. I said, do you mean to tell me, I said, that you know that you've got no call to go to America and yet you're going to take up a ministerial work? And he looked at me with a very hurt expression on his face and said, well, he said, don't you want me to go? Which wasn't the answer to my question at all. Bevan, I said, whether I want you to go or not has got nothing to do with it. I said, one thing I do know, and that is this, that I wouldn't stir one inch unless I knew God was with me. Not even one inch. I said, if you want to go to America, I said, you go, I shan't stop you. I said, I won't go with you. I said, I won't stand beside you. Neither does the church in Australia. But I said, if you're determined to go, I said, you go. I said, and you take the consequence. But I said, if you take my advice, I said, you'll forget the whole thing. Cancel your airline ticket and stay right home here and go to work where God has put you and demonstrate here that you do have a message and you can help people. Well, despite that warning, he came. And what is more, he came on tithe money. Now, not the tithe money of any believers, but Margaret Morrison, and you know, here's a very, very curious thing, you'll notice this at times, that there are some people who will do the most outrageous things. They'll break the Sabbath, they'll commit adultery, they'll murmur against the truth of God and the people of God, they'll cause all kinds of trouble in the camp of Israel, and yet they'll most faithfully put their tithe away week by week, most faithfully. To me, that's a strange thing, because if you do all those other things and persist in them, you don't get heaven anyway, so you might as well spend the money on yourself, mightn't you? Why pay your tithe? But she faithfully put it away, and she sold the property. This is Margaret Morrison. She sold the property, and the accumulated tithe from all this over a couple of years and the sale of the property apparently put it together enough for Bevan to come to America. And I think this money came across here as well, which he put into his pocket, and it was sufficient for him to buy a round-trip ticket to come to America. And I might mention that when you apply for a visa the first time to come to America as a tourist, you must present a round trip ticket before you can get the visa, unless the law has been changed since I first got my visa, but that's the rule. The second year, of course, it doesn't matter, you can come on the same visa with a one-way ticket and do what you like, but the first time you must show a round trip ticket. So Bevan, as far as I can see, we'd have to have a round-trip ticket before he left. And I asked him, I said, do you have a return ticket? He said, yes, a round-trip ticket, yes, I've got a round-trip ticket. So he came to America on tithe money but without a call from God. He came here to be a self-sent messenger. Now I'd like to give to you today a number of reasons as to why God is not in the call of Bevan the world to America, and if God is not in it, then not one of us can be in it either. That's logical, isn't it? Number one, and here they come, as best I can recall them now. I have 10 altogether if I can recall them, but I usually can only get to about 8. Sometimes I make the 10. Point number one, he himself confessed he had no call from God to come to America. Therefore, by his own confession, he's a self-sent messenger. Point number two is this, that the entire church in Australia recognizes the fact that all of Bevan's past history disqualifies him to ever be a worker for God. Point number three is this, that wherever he goes, he scatters and divides. He doesn't build up the work of God. Point number four, he's a teacher of false doctrine and undermines the message of God's truth today. Point number five, his call came from a man living in open adultery and manifest sin, and also a man who was trying to take God's place to organize the work of God himself. There's point number five. Point number six, he does not have a good name amongst the people with whom he works in the outside world, which Timothy says it must be. Point number seven, he is not a man who brings up his family after him. And there are seven solid points, and there are three more which I just can't think of right offhand, but those seven, of course, are more than enough to disqualify a man to be a worker in the cause of God. Yes, that's right. Number eight, he put his hands upon the tide when he had no business to touch it. So there are eight solid points as to why that man does not give unmistakable evidence to be a worker in the cause of God. Now, in the light of these facts, and they're facts, and as I said, no one can preach the message which I preach and be a liar. You just can't mix those two things together. Now, in the light of those facts, can you understand why we viewed the coming of Bevan to America with grave alarm and concern? And why we did our duty and sounded a note of warning to all those over in this country whom we could? And can you see why it would be impossible for us to stand behind and give our support to a man like that? Now, Bevan de Ruyter, Lucifer, as you remember, was determined to set himself up in the kingdom of heaven in the position of his own choice. And when he couldn't do it there, then he came down to this earth and he's been trying ever since to do upon this earth what he couldn't do in heaven. And Bevan de Ruyter, when he couldn't do this thing in Australia, when he found every door closed against him there, then he's come to America to try and do in this country what he couldn't do in Australia. And over here, he'll be just as unsuccessful as he ever was down there in the country down under. What he's going to do from here on out, I don't know for certain. I'm looking forward to getting home to Australia and having a confrontation with him, and we'll see what happens from there on out. I know this much, that I have a letter from him in which he said he plans to come back to America and live over here permanently, but whether he does or not remains to be seen. I do know this much, if he comes to be an immigrant, he's up against some pretty difficult things, because the American government makes it quite difficult these days for people to immigrate to America, because they reckon they already have enough people to share their wealth with, so they don't open the doors too readily for folk coming from other countries. It might take him 2 years to make it. Then again, of course, the devil might work things out and he comes over here much more quickly. So there's the story, and if you have any questions to ask, then feel free to ask them.